This week, we learn about a universal language, or rather, an attempt at it. The language of the birds? Not really. Emoticons? No, something else. Albert Mackey tells us all about it. Then, we'll dive right back into the work of speculative Freemasonry with the second part of a two-part article published on UniversalFreemasonry.org. What was the true influence of the Rosicrucian Brotherhood on Freemasonry? And what are its alchemical correlations to the degree work? From tangible to the intangible to an internal mythic quest of changing man, silver, to gold. All this and a little bit more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 580. I want to thank our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners of the WCY podcast for assisting us in the production of this show, which has been going since July of 2011. If you'd like to learn more about how you can help produce quality Masonic education and be a part of this podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com and click on Support the Show. We've also got a shop, as well as a bookstore with Amazon links, which are affiliate linked based on my own personal recommended reading and listening lists and books by those who've been on the show, as well as recommended by our guests. All money goes back to help this podcast and bring you quality Masonic education. If you've signed up to support the podcast in the last couple of months, my apologies. Things have been really hectic. You all might know that I've been going through some family changes here with my mom and things. So if I owe you something because you are at the contributor, fellow, producer, or legacy partner level, I am planning on getting all caught up with those things and check your mailboxes just after the first of the month. In terms of the presentation schedule, the cat's out of the bag. I think I announced last week that I'll be at South Pasadena Masonic Lodge number 290 doing The Philosophy of Kings, Friedrich Nietzsche's Übermensch and the Royal Art. This is a brand new presentation that I'll be doing just for them, and we'll go into the repertoire of various talks that I can do for any lodge, but they will be the first and premier, as it is a special event, the first talk of their 10th year of the Illumination Lecture Series. So if that sounds interesting to you, awesome. If not, well, let me just tell you that the philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche really has changed the world. And whether you know about him or his books or things about them or what has come up in pop culture, I think there is a very valuable comparison of philosophies to be explored. And that is what I've done here in this particular all-new presentation. So I hope to see you there if you're able to come out. Now, let's do something kind of fun before we get into the second part of the great work of speculative masonry. We read part one last week. More on that in a moment. Let's go ahead and click this really wonky letter-picking wheel from a website here that we used. It selected the letter L. So, I'm going to head over to my copy of Mackey's Encyclopedia. We're going to open up L, and I'm going to randomly put my finger down on a page on L. Let's see what we have. And let's hope we don't end up somewhere in the landmarks, because that would just be absolutely terrible. Okay, I've landed on language, comma, universal, as in the universal language. And what does it say on this entry? Let's go ahead and check it out. The invention of a universal language, which men of all nations could understand and through which they could communicate their thoughts, has always been one of the dreams of certain philologists. In the 17th century, Delgarno had written his Ars Signorum to prove the possibility of a universal character and a philosophical language. About the same time, Bishop Wilkins published his essay Towards a Real Character and a Philosophical Language. And even the mathematical Leibniz entertained the project of a universal language for all of the world. It is not therefore surprising that when the so-called Leland manuscript stated that the Freemasons concealed a quote-unquote universal language, John Locke, or whoever was the commenter on that document, should have been attracted by the statement. He says, "A universal language has been much desired by the learned of many ages. It is a thing rather to be wished than hoped for. But it seems the Masons pretend to have such a thing among them. If it be true, I guess it must be something like a language of the pantomimes among the ancient Romans, who are said to be able, by signs only, to express and deliver any oration intelligibly to men of all nations and languages. The guess of the commentator was near the truth. A universal language founded on words is utterly impracticable, even if once inaugurated by common consent, a thing itself impossible. The lapse of but a few years and the continual innovation of new phrases would soon destroy its universality. But there are signs and symbols which, by tacit consent, have always been recognized as the exponents of certain ideas, and these are everywhere understood. It is well known that such a system exists over the vast territory occupied by the North American Indians, or First Nations, and that these First Nations of two tribes, which totally differ in language, meeting on their prairie or in the forest, are enabled by conventual signs of universal agreement to hold long and intelligible intercourse. On such a basis, the universal language of Freemasonry is founded. It is not universal to the world, but it is to the craft, and a Freemason of one country and language meeting a Freemason of another can make himself understood for all practical purposes of the craft, simply because the system of signs and symbols has been so perfected that in every language they convey the same meaning and make the same impression. This, and this only, is the extent to which the universal language of Freemasonry reaches. It would be an error to suppose that it meets the expectations of Delgarno or Wilkinson or any other dreamer, and that it is so perfect as to supersede the necessity of any other method of intercommunication. Thus far, Brother Mackey, whose comments on Masonic universality are as applicable today as when his words were written, though his criticisms of the possibilities in universal languages are less successful in the view of the work accomplished in that direction since his day and generation. However, we must admit that the same prejudice exists and is likely to persist and long continue. Part of this objection is due to a misunderstanding, a belief that the projected language is intended to take the place of some national tongue. But this is an error. At best, the attempts have been directed at an easily acquired auxiliary means of spoken and written communication, an agency especially promising of purpose in the world that is so readily misled by lack of correct knowledge concerning the peoples of the earth. Surely this is a task important to all brethren of the craft. As to the earlier attempts to which Brother Mackey alludes, they were failures, it is true. Delgamo's Ars Signorum of 1661 and Wilkins's Real Character of 1668 failed because of insufficient foundation. The preliminary scientific labor had not then been done. But what was attempted was deserving of admiration, and Wilkins in particular made a contribution to phonetics that is valuable among experts of modern times, while his classifications of ideas was the acknowledged forerunner of later efforts by Robert and Linnaeus. More recently, we have had Volapük of 1880, Esperanto, 1887, and Idiom Neutral, 1902. Of these, the second is admittedly the most reasonable and practical artificial language. Born as it was among the feuds of four races using different languages, its inventor, Dr. L. Zamenhof, believed that the evil could be remedied by a neutral speech. A Masonic lodge using Esperanto was established at Paris, one has been planned for London, and an international group of Freemasons using Esperanto has also functioned. See Universals Framasona Ligo. Fascinating. Now, I only know one brother in the whole world of all the brothers I know Esperanto, and that is Brother Nick Johnson. No relation. Brother Nick had been with us in the forerunner years of the Masonic Roundtable, and you can hear him talk a little bit about that in some of the episodes, kind of as little fun asides that we'll get into those conversations. When I first saw the title of Language Universal, I first went to the idea of the language of birds, this kind of idea that Adam, the first man, spoke the same language as all of the animals. There was a secret language that was known, that was lost, or perhaps the singular tongue that everyone was purported to have had at the building of the Tower of Babel before God smote the people and gave them different tongues. Regardless of mythology or Gnostic interpretations of a universal language, this idea of a practical universal language is kind of true in Freemasonry, in that there are things I can speak of around the profane that relate to the profane world, but I can talk about them in Masonic terms, and my brothers understand what I'm talking about. So it is quite interesting that we've done this work. And language in whole is so interesting. How cultures and civilizations develop these things. And recently, I was reading an article. Well, it probably wasn't so recently, but it was this idea that man is starting to return to a language of symbols. That's right, through the text message and emojis. We are turning the tides back to a communication of emotion rather than one of exact science. It's interesting. And turning it back how far? Well, one only has to look at a language that uses types of hieroglyphics in order to understand. But even hieroglyphics can be rather specific. But I guess it's all in context and how they're used together. All right, let's get into the second part of the great work of speculative Freemasonry. Now, this again was published on December 21st, 2022, a little over a month ago. The first part we read in the last episode, which would have been episode number 579. You can find that on our website or anywhere else you listen to your podcasts. The byline on these articles says Dr. George Oliver, but Dr. George Oliver lived and died well before some of the references being talked about in this essay, so rather what we have, I think, is a part of Dr. George Oliver's work being examined here by a yet unnamed brother of the craft. And so here we go. The Great Work of Speculative Freemasonry, Part 2, Dr. George Oliver. In the concluding portion of Dr. George Oliver's profound essay, we examine in depth the relationship between Freemasonry, alchemy, and the Hermetic lore of the Rosicrucians. In the light of the foregoing, it will be seen that Freemasonry depends for its life and strength on the ancient wisdom teaching, which is enshrined in it, a teaching designed to answer those eternal questions as to the why, the whence, and the whither of all human existence. These indeed are the deepest problems of life, and ultimately we are concerned only with their solution, for sooner or later we are forced to inquire, why live at all? Why exert ourselves in any personal or social endeavor, if we know not whither it all leads? The problems of why and whither of human life are those which have ever occupied thinking men. They are at the bottom of every philosophic system, and the systems themselves are but an attempt to answer them. And yet no words can ever fully answer these problems, for no language can express the reality of life. This can only be experienced by the living soul of man. As Emerson truly says, quote, "The soul answers never by words, but by the thing itself that is inquired after," end quote. It is the experience of life that answers are found, and only the man who has lived deeply is really wise. The wisdom of the sage is the sum total of his human experience, but even he cannot impart his knowledge to others. They, in their turn, must first experience the realities of life, for only by such means do they attain to a wider consciousness. How then is it possible that anything so profound and intimate as what Freemasonry calls the center in man can be held fast as a permanent force acting in the world of phenomena? It is possible, in virtue of the special power represented by tradition. A spiritual tradition is never objective knowledge nor practice which has become mechanical, but a living continuance of the living impulse which created it. Every great initiation system, so long as it progresses, is guided by enlightened minds, distinguishes clearly between its ritual and oral tradition. It is on the oral tradition that the main stress is laid. Tradition alone can teach how the text of a ritual ought to be understood, which, in the end, is the only thing that matters. Whosoever claims that he can extract the original meaning from the text of the ritual without help of tradition is really only reading his own meaning into it. And it is only if the two minds are specially congenial, or the one has a special gift for entertaining into the mind of another, that the new meaning in any measure coincides with the old. What is true of comprehension is even more generally true of being. for comprehension too is handed on as a state of being. Here the universally valid law is manifest, that everywhere like works upon like, hence the eternal validity of the relation of master and disciple, and the tradition referenced in our Masonic lectures, quote unquote, to seek for a master and from him to gain instruction, first section, first lecture. The widening of consciousness gained by direct experience is so great that, as shown in the traditional ceremony of admission into the craft, it is called an initiation. A new beginning. A new life does indeed begin for him who has been regularly initiated into the mysteries. An actual change has taken place in him. And needless to add, no words could ever accomplish as much. The candidate for initiation in the schools of ancient mysteries therefore did not attain merely by hearing and repeating words, but always by undergoing the process conferred upon him by already initiated masters or experts, an experience which resulted in an expansion of his consciousness. St. Clement of Alexandria testifies to this when he writes, quote, "But the mysteries are delivered mystically. That which is spoken may be in the mouth of the speaker, not in his voice, but rather in his understanding. The writing of these memoranda of mine, I well know, is weak when compared with that of spirit, full of grace which I was privileged to hear. But it will be an image to recall the archetype to him who was struck by the thyrsus." Stromatis, Book 1, Chapter 28. Such an experience was of necessity always reserved for the few, but notwithstanding, some shadow of it was also within reach of those who, although not fully qualified to become initiates, were nonetheless genuine seekers for knowledge. For them, there were the lesser mysteries, in which the actual change in consciousness did not quite take place, but something of its meaning was conveyed to the candidate by his participation in a series of rites in which the chief events of the greater mysteries were presented to him in a dramatized form. We can now proceed to judge of what supreme importance the influence of the Rosy Cross was to speculative masonry. The mysteries of the Rosy Cross were the greater mysteries, as we know from the testimony of those who were admitted to them, and the contract of the Rosicrucians with Freemasonry undoubtedly resulted in the gradual importation into Masonic lodges of teaching derived from more hidden and exalted sources. Many students of the craft system are unaware of the great value of literary works attributed to Rosicrucian authorship. These works call for our serious study because their contents are directly related to that body of science and doctrine concerning human nature and its perfectibility, which the concealed founders of the craft system subtly and under deep veils of phrasing planted in the soil of Masonic ritual. The Hermetic lore, as the body of the Rosicrucian teaching is often called, comprehends both a spiritual and physical science, a science of the spirit, and a science of nature. Both of these elements of the Rosicrucian wisdom are also to be understood by the use of the term great work. And while it is true that the goal of the Hermetic philosopher included such knowledge as would enable him to transmute base metals, there was the higher or spiritual aspect in which the laboratory was man himself, the base metals his own lower nature, and the transmutation, that change by which, through mystic death, putrefactio, a rebirth, regeneratio, took place. Modern scholarship, of course, still leaves unsolved the question of the correct classification of Rosicrucian alchemical treatises as mystical, magic, or simply primitively chemical. The most reasonable view, however, is surely that which is propounded in the treatises themselves, namely that the physical problem of the transmutation of base metals into gold is, in essence, the same as that of man's physical regeneration. Michael Sendivogius alludes to this conception of the work in his treatise appropriately entitled New Chemical Light, as follows, quote, "The sages have been taught of God that this natural world is only an image, a material copy of a heavenly and spiritual pattern, that the very existence of this world is based upon the reality of its celestial archetype, and that God has created in an imitation of the spiritual and invisible universe, in order that men might be better enabled to comprehend his heavenly teaching, and the wonder of his absolute and ineffable power and wisdom. Thus the sages sees heaven reflected in nature as in a mirror, and he pursues this art, not for the sake of gold or silver, but for the love of knowledge which it reveals, He jealously conceals it from the sinner and the scornful, lest the mysteries of heaven should be laid bare to the vulgar gaze. New Chemical Light, Part 11, Concerning Sulfur. The work for which the craft was designed is described in the language of alchemy as the Argon primary work. The work of natural science and the making of physical gold is but the Paragon secondary work. In the sense of the primary work, gold is the attribute of divinity and closely connected with fire as a spiritual emblem. Quote, "But he knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold." Job 23, verse 10. "Every man's work shall be made manifest, for the day shall declare it, because it shall be revealed by fire. And the fire shall try every man's work of what sort it is." 1 Corinthians 3, verse 13. The doctrine of Freemasonry in relation to the Rosicrucian mystery teachings can best be appreciated after a preliminary statement of some of the basic principles on which it is affirmed rests all progress in the royal art. There is, however, independent evidence of the Rosicrucian influence on the genesis of the craft system. Historical research indicates that the originators of speculative Freemasonry, the members of the so-called Invisible Society, simultaneously with launching the craft, arranged for the formation of the Royal Society, which became chartered in 1662 for the advancement of scientific knowledge. Strictly in accordance with the Hermetic wisdom, therefore, the Invisibles projected two systems. One, the craft intended to be devoted to mystical studies and personal spiritual development, and the other, the Royal Society aiming at the promotion of the natural sciences upon occult principles and under the guidance of qualified experts. Science in the popular mind represents nothing more than the body of those beliefs, conclusions, or generalizations which individual scientists at various times put forth in a tentative way as landmarks, so to speak, in their endless search for increasingly valid formulations of reality. It is to these conclusions, often called facts, that we allude when we state that science teaches this or that. But strictly speaking, science does not teach anything at all. It is a method rather than a body of conclusions, and it is scientific method in speculative Freemasonry with which we are here concerned. Let us illustrate by a few specific examples. We live in a world which the ordinary man accepts as reality, existing quite independently of himself. To him it is supremely real, and to doubt this fact would seem to be sheer madness. Yet he cannot fathom his own relation to this world, and he cannot adequately explain how he actually perceives it. Is it by means of the senses? If so, how does the sense impression affect consciousness? When we see an object, all we can be sure of is that something outside us affected our eyes by means of vibrations of a definite rate, that our optic nerves convey the impression to the brain cells, that a chemical change takes place there, and then we see the object. We are aware of a certain shape, various colors and textures, what mystery has taken place by means of which the chemical change in the gray matter of the brain has created in our consciousness the image of the object. And, having seen, as we say, what do we, after all, really know about the object? Similarly, in the attempt to formulate philosophical exposition of the world and life experience, almost any first statement we make can be seized upon and criticized as one-sided, and therefore untrue. The world is a unity. The world is pluralistic. Time is continuous. Time is composed of irreducible atomic elements. The world comes to the individual from without. The world of the individual is a world of inner experience. Each of these premises is attributed to be true in one respect to another. But how are they true? In what sense are they true? In what general point of view can be set up in accordance with which the apparent conflicts are resolved? Is this world a dream world, daily existence, friends, work? Is it all fantastic illusion? Yes and no. This is a paradox. The world in which we live is real and yet unreal. The mystery of its relation to us and its measure of reality can only be disclosed in the depths of our own consciousness. Plato compares ordinary men to prisoners bound in a cave of which they can see only the back wall. On this wall fall shadows cast by those who pass the mouth of the cave. The play of shadows is the prisoner's world. It is reality to them, but whenever one of them succeeds in freeing himself and sees the entrance, sees the light and the real beings moving in it, then he realizes that he has lived in a world of illusion, that he has been in a state of darkness, and that his eyes have been hoodwinked. We must know ourselves in order to know the world. The man, therefore, who becomes proficient in that most interesting of all human studies, the knowledge of himself, renounces the popular world and gradually attains consciousness in a world described as not to be touched by hand or to be seen by eye, but otherwise supremely real. Withdrawal from this world of illusion, however, involves a transition from the ordinary natural state and standard of living towards what is and as the regenerate state, with its correspondingly higher standard. A word now upon the faculty to be employed in the apprehension of interior truth. It is often remarked that a natural timidity affects those to whom is suggested a transition from old and familiar roads of study, comfortably chartered and lit with the bright lamps of convention, to a new and unknown path of research striking away into the darkness of obscurity beyond the official boundaries of orthodox systems of knowledge. The earnest seeker after truth, however, fortified by the will to know, soon learns that the outer darkness of investigation reveals rare lights of its own, and is in fact but darkness visible, although light of a quality hitherto undiscerned. In this difficult study, knowing depends entirely upon doing. Comprehension is conditional upon the corollary of action. He that will do the will shall know of the doctrine. For the doing automatically liberates an inward faculty capable of directly cognizing self-evident truth. We know not how to describe a faculty which, when awakened, exists and functions in complete independence of the physical organism. In our Masonic system, as in other treatises of arcane physiology, it is described in analogy with the natural luminary as the sun to rule the day, whilst the logical understanding is the moon to govern the night and direct the merely temporal affairs of life. This later embracing, as it does the reasoning, faculty, and tie lower or objective mind, is appointed to serve as a light in the natural world, but the gift notwithstanding, it forms a cloud of darkness as regards light from the spiritual element that is both within and without us, and indeed may obscure all spiritual vision, not until man has learned to regulate this quote-unquote lesser light to its appropriate use in the natural world can he, walking in darkness, hope to see the great luminary which, invisible to the physical sense, but present in the central depths of his nature, lightens every man coming into the world, and which, to those who have clean hands and pure hearts, are fitted to evoke it, manifests in mental illumination and expanded consciousness. We turn now from the psychologic to the metaphysical aspect of the great work. The entire object of the royal art of the Rosicrucians and spiritual alchemists is said to be the uncovering of the inner faculty of insight and wisdom, alluded to above, and the removal of the veils intervening between the mind and dividing it from its hidden divine root. Not only does this science envisage an individual in whom the several constituents of consciousness are united, but it aspires toward the development of an integrated and free man who is likewise building up in the present life what is known in the technical language of mysticism as the resurrection or arch-natural body. This is also the profound idea which governs our symbolic craft of masonry, the raising of a superstructure, perfect in all its parts and honorable to the builder. As to the metaphysical material of which these structures are to be reared, the Hermetic and alchemical schools adopted the mystical terms of Scripture and called it a stone, the Philosopher's Stone. It is, indeed, the white stone which is given to him that overcometh, the lower nature as that apostle did, who thereupon received the name that implies a stone. For it is only then that the individual aspirant becomes a foundation, a rock, upon which may be erected a temple, a personal sanctuary of the spirit, whose abode is the souls of men rather than the temples made with hands. The teaching of the alchemists demonstrates how this stone must be confected, worked up, in the individual by a manual art, like our Masonic art, not to be understood in the literal sense, from chaos to perfection. They describe the work as undergoing three stages, the black, the white, and the red, which are the alchemical equivalents of the three degrees of speculative Freemasonry. Thus, as psychologically, regeneration involves the three traditional stages of purgation, illumination, and union, so metaphysically, there are three corresponding stages of corporeal development. To each of these may be added a fourth. Although unlikely of achievement in this life, the attainment of divine union in permanence, which during physical life can only be temporary and partial, and the corresponding perfecting and consolidation of an arc or arch natural vesture perfect holiness, belongs only to the Lord. The first stage in alchemy, the stone at the black in Freemasonry, a poor candidate in a state of darkness, is intended to typify the benighted mind and unclarified state of the soul's vestiture at the outset of the great work. At this stage, the physical nature must be accounted an integral factor in the work and is to be dedicated and employed accordingly. It is the vessel or crucible in which the alchemical change is to be wrought. But the regimen enjoined is, quote-unquote, the renewing of your mind, not the maceration of the body. For, in a deeper than the familiar sense, corpus sanum will ensue surely enough upon the mens sana. The second stage, in alchemy, the stone at the white. In Freemasonry, clothed in white apron and gloves, as an emblem of innocence, signifies that the clouded mind and the soul's black vesture of earth have been cleansed by the baptism of a fall of water, the alchemical remedy of the elixir of life. The third stage in alchemy, the stone at the red. In Freemasonry, the sublime degree symbolizes entrance into the sanctuary and denotes the aspirant whose purified soul enters the experience of the divine union. Following the alchemical precedent, Freemasonry recognizes that the third stage involves two operations known in alchemy as the refining of silver and gold, and accordingly the three degrees of Freemasonry also include the Holy Royal Arch of Jerusalem as their climax. The clothing, therefore, worn in the Master Mason degree is distinguished by silver, the first of the noble or precious metals, whereas in the Royal Arch degree, the completion of the Master Mason degree is adorned with gold. The transmutation has now been effected. In the Holy Royal Arch, the soul is all glorious within, and the clothing is of wrought gold. Wrought, since gold indicates that holy ultimate substance, which although always latent in each one of us, like gold dust in common soil, needs mining, refining, and working up by skillful craftsmanship before becoming a jewel for the king's treasury. Lastly, the gold must be tried in fire. The growing celestial body must be perfected and fixated until capable of eternal endurance in the burning heat of divine penetralia. This perfecting is scarcely to be looked for in the present life, but its achievement, as the state attained by those who become king and priests unto God, is symbolically attested in speculative Freemasonry by those robes worn by those who are called to corresponding rank in the outer chapter, the prince, prelates of the Grand Sanhedrin, represented in the persons of the three principles. Our thought in this paper has reached high ground, but we have labored to be lucid in speaking of things exacting unwanted claims upon the normal understanding, and that although the subject of an abundant literature have ever been expressed in terms of great restraint and concealment, the understanding of these things will be assisted by realizing physical things to be in faithful correspondence with metaphysical, and that as we advance from the one to the other, we employ in turn the self-blinded eye of sense, the closed eye of faith, and the opened eye of the soul. At the beginning of the quest, the aspirant is conscious of only the things of the physical order. Let him, however, commit himself with bandaged eyes to his instinct and the possibility of a great self-transfiguration, believing that, quote, my covenant is with the seer, the hoodwink is removed, and faith possesses into sight. His eyes see the salvation prepared before the face of all the people, but hidden from them by a passing blindness, and he can testify that in the very deed the tabernacle of God is within men, and not elsewhere. We will conclude with a quotation from Plotinus, which may serve to illustrate the position of this study circle in relation to our brethren of the craft. Quote, "If we speak and write, it is but as guides to those who long to see. We send them to the place itself, bidding them from words to the vision. The teaching is of the path and the plan. Seeing is the work of each soul for itself." Plotinus, Enid, 6, 9.4, Stephen McKenna. So mote it be. Very much different from the first piece, which was much more historical and dipping the toes in the side of the esoteric nature of really this concept that they're trying to convey. And here in this piece, The Great Works of Speculative Masonry, Part 2, I found the piece to be very interesting, but also one that I did have to read a few times in order to really understand what they were trying to say. The author uses some terms and some beautiful language that is just a little bit harder for somebody like me to really comprehend the first read through. But that's just me. Maybe you're like me, maybe you're not. Maybe you're probably all faster than I am. So I hope you guys enjoyed it. Maybe you want to listen to this one again, or there'll be a link back in the show notes. You can read it for yourself, or, you know, have Siri read it or something along those lines. We'll be back next week with a tarot reading. We're going to look at the deck called the Real Talk Tarot, and I did post a quick little sneak peek of that on our TikTok page, which is under the Wizard of Arge. It's all, every space is actually an underscore. So the Wizard of ARJ, the Wizard of Arge. And we'll use that tarot deck to do a little bit of a contemplative experience next week. So I want to thank you all for joining me on this edifying journey, as Brother Juan likes to say. One more time, I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of the show. And if you want to learn more about how you can help support this program, please head on over to WCYpodcast.com. Now, before I sign off this week, I must tell you all about the 2023 Midwest Conference on Masonic Education, happening on April 28th through the 30th. It'll be in Canton, Ohio, at the Canton Masonic Temple. Friday evening, there's going to be a welcome conference, a social hour. They're going to do something called Search for Light at the Canton Masonic Temple, the debut of a new social and educational Masonic event. They'll have a lot of fun there. There'll be a social in the temple room. Then on Saturday, there'll be some breakfast, joint session, morning session, afternoon sessions. Be there for our conference, as it is a Grand Lodge event. You know, you may have all heard of the Conference of Grand Masters. Well, this is kind of a Midwest conference on Masonic education, but we've begun to spread our wings and pretty much take over the entire United States. It's the only regional Masonic education conference at the Grand Lodge level that has continued to exist, and we have opened up the bylaws to essentially let anybody join. You can have an individual membership. You get a vote at the annual conference, a voice in the direction of the Masonic Conference of Masonic Education. You also get an opportunity to present at the annual conference and a discount on annual conference fees. There's an organizational membership and a jurisdictional membership. So if you're interested in this, please check it out. Of course, the timing for this conference is coming up, so you're going to want to go register, and you're going to book at the Courtyard Canton Hotel. The room rate is $129 a night. You'll need it for two nights, and, you know, split the bill with your brother. Drive down and check it out. It's a 6.5-hour drive from where I'm coming from. I'm driving down for sure. I know good friend and brother Spencer Hammond, and there's a conference hotel and all of that. So we may or may not meet on Sunday. It depends if they wrap up all the business on Saturday. But nonetheless, Friday night, awesome. Saturday and all day Saturday will be great. And if you want to learn more, please go to mcme1949.org. And you'll just click on the events tab. So there you go. Check it out. I hope to see you there. It's going to be rad. Again, don't forget about the South Pasadena Masonic Lodges presentation coming up in the next couple of weeks. And that's it. So until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
That's it. Here's your own.